if you want to trust the system, that's what Bitcoin's for. I mean, that's why it's a state change. It's this unbelievable tool that really empowers people to have trustless settlement without a trusted third party. I think the thing that people miss about this, though, of course, is that this also empowers the baddies or the US government or the private sector ghouls that have, you know, run crony capitalism for the last 50 years plus or whatever, right? So I think that this idea that Bitcoin just eliminates corruption is just ridiculous. Of course not. There can be corruption in a Bitcoin system.
Dude, this article, good Lord, you and Whitney, Whitney Webb, for those that might not know Whitney, you sent this out. I started reading through it and I'm there like, I don't know, a half hour later. I think this takes about an hour, maybe a little bit more to go through this entire article. And I'm just, anytime I read content from you or Whitney, I'm just kind of left like, how in the world do they do this amount of research in a single lifetime? This is like a book. The amount of work and everything you guys put into this, this is wild. But yeah, welcome to the show. Sorry to keep going on. Thanks. Sorry to just keep going on, but thanks for coming on the show. And I want to start off with this. And the name of this article is The Chain of Custody, The Mafia Holding the Elite's Bitcoin. So zinger of a title, but let's start here. This is like, what were you guys trying to accomplish in a very simple way? Describe it very simply for the audience. What were you guys trying to accomplish with this article?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think as always, right, you know, I've done editing for a long time now. I think the best work always comes from stuff that you're really like passionate about and interested in. And, you know, this work, this kind of research vein we've been on for the last like 6 months or something like that, you know, we've probably put out 4 or 5 articles, you know, has really kind of been looking at this, you know, sort of, you know, where does intelligence and, you know, private capital, venture capital connect? And then where does this sort of new financial system, this kind of idea of the Bitcoin dollar, you know, where do these groups kind of come and meet in the middle? So obviously Whitney's like kind of quite literally written the book on, you know, kind of the first part of that, the, intelligence affiliated venture capital and the mob kind of, you know, and intelligence sort of meeting with, you know, fintech and, you know, technology firms and the public sector. And then I've written, obviously, you know, a bit about the Bitcoin dollar. You know, I wrote a book called The Bitcoin Dollar, for Bitcoin Magazine. And, yeah, so we've just been sort of kind of picking away at this, from two different angles. And, you know, this research vein is really met in the middle, for better or for worse, you know, good for, you know, content, but, you know, maybe the implications aren't so fantastic, but I would say in general, you know, this is kind of the first one we've ever done kind of, you know, key takeaways at the beginning. Had a lot of people reach out about the last one, Debt from Above, this kind of piece about this, satellite company, and kind of saying that they had tried running it through a bunch of like, you know, LLMs and trying to do, you know, machine assisted submissions. And it was actually rejecting it, saying that, you know, this is a pretty conspiratorial piece with a lot of accusations in it. So we're actually not going to grok it for you. So this one, we decided to do it for the people. So, you know, right at the beginning, there's kind of these key takeaways. But I would say in general, you know, it is sort of this looking at intelligence affiliated VC firms, how since kind of the late 90s dot-com boom, you know, have really just dominated the tech industry in general, and specifically the financial tech industry. And then looking at how these firms have kind of gone from being, you know, a profit generating via kind of like, you know, consumer revenue coming in, you know, from customers, and rather being about creating these free to use networks, generating hordes of data, and then selling that data to, you know, data brokers, intelligence agencies, what have you, and basically using customer data as sort of like a new commodity. So that's still going on, obviously. And kind of the biggest people that are sort of the most known for this, maybe the most successful of this, are, you know, the Facebook affiliated groups. And then, of course, PayPal, the PayPal mafia, sort of this like infamous group of folks that, you know, Reid Hoffman went on. Was a big part of this piece, you know, to do LinkedIn, You know, PayPal was then bought by Pierre Omidyar's eBay. eBay was kind of one of the first groups to really do this, you know, data broker, you know, basically private intelligence group. So yeah, kind of looking at these intelligence affiliated VC firms and how they are, you know, now really moving into the digital asset space, extremely so. And then also kind of looking at these entrepreneurial social groups, you know, how do you kind of I'll use the word control, but how do you sort of influence, you know, the people behind these groups, the CEOs, kind of right at incubation, of these startups, you know, kind of kicking off? And, you know, in the COVID era, you know, we learned a lot about the World Economic Forum's young global leaders and how they sort of, you know, there was that great Klaus Schwab quote of like, you know, we infiltrate the cabinets, and, you know, how there was this sort of, world lockstep kind of response to COVID. Well, you know, you had a lot of these sort of social groups that was focused on the public sector, you know, again, infiltrating the cabinets and kind of being, you know, a lot of the world leaders are, you know, significantly influenced by these social groups. So now we're kind of looking at these, not so much the public sector, but the private sector social groups. So this group in particular, that's a big part of the focus of this piece, is Endeavor, which is very similar to like a YGL. But really looking at the private sector emerging markets entrepreneurs. And the reason why they do this is because they can kind of mask, you know, this commonality of funding coming from a small group of people in this sort of like, you know, oh, this is so great. It's this wonderful free market blossoming of innovation in Argentina. But really, you know, it's like a couple people like a Pierre Omidyar and Edgar Bronfman Jr., or Reid Hoffman, who are using, you know, their funding and their influence to, you know, basically invest and influence into these like now core infrastructure groups of the modern economy. So looking at this Endeavor group, and unfortunately seeing a lot of ties to like a Jeffrey Epstein, a Nexium, these kind of more coercive influential groups, these, you know, maybe even blackmail rings, you could say. So looking at all that, seeing all this coming together, and then the piece sort of focuses a little bit on, you know, this one Bitcoin group, this company in particular, Zappo, sort of funded by this legendary Bitcoiner, Wences Casares, who's kind of considered the patient zero of Silicon Valley, orange pilled Thiel and Hoffman, and, you know, brought it to all of these, these stalwarts of kind of the American, you know, intelligence, information broker, entrepreneurs, you know, mostly coming out of California. And looking at Zappo, you know, really interestingly enough, you know, they're very Endeavor affiliated. Wences is coming out of Argentina, which is where Endeavor, you know, it's focusing on emerging markets, Latin America specifically. And then you look at the first advisory board of Zappo, and seeing D Hawk from Visa, John Reed from Citi, and Larry Summers, sort of, you know, from the Treasury and from a bunch of other private and public sector kind of revolving door, you know, when it's convenient in the private sector, when it's convenient in the public. So there's a lot to learn from these guys, because, you know, these guys are sort of the proto architects of what, you know, we call the Bitcoin dollar system, are all right there on the Zappo board. And then you look at what does Zappo do? It's basically set the benchmark for, you know, custody, really, like, you know, doing absurd things, putting keys in space, drilling, you know, vaults and Swiss bunkers, and, you know, developing these pretty crazy biometric systems for like really strong key management. And then, of course, at the same time, kind of facilitating, you know, stable coin and U.S. dollar banking, and connecting it, you know, very importantly to the Bitcoin system. So that's the overview of the piece. Quite a bit, yes, of a rant there. But but that's basically,
a lot here.
Yeah. So that's the brief overview. And of course, this is just part one. But yeah, I'll stop there. But that's more or less what we've been working on here.
I just want to highlight, so people that listen to our show are familiar with a company called Zappos, the shoe company. This was the Tony Hsieh company. Mm. We are not talking about that Zappos. This one is spelled X-A-P-O. It's Now, you might have to help me here. I saw Gibraltar and I saw headquartered in Switzerland. Which one of those two is it?
Yeah, well, they were
Spain or Switzerland.
So they came out of Argentina. That was where he funded it. But yeah, they re-registered in Gibraltar. For jurisdictional reasons. Yeah. And then the actual, like, kind of infamous Zappo vaults are in Switzerland.
In Switzerland. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Where I want to jump to right out of the gate. So you talk about Bitcoin dollars. And I think for the audience, when they hear you say that, they're saying, what does he mean by a Bitcoin dollar? Explain this as simply as possible.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, I've done this quite a bit now. I think the easiest way just to sort of establish the analogy is, you know, Bitcoin dollar a la petrodollar. So it's probably the easiest analog. And the idea is much like the petrodollar. Well, let's explain the petrodollar, right? So, you know, Nixon shock, early 70s, the U.S. decides to cut from, you know, a gold-backed standard where you could actually take your, you know, your reserve notes, go to a bank and get gold back. Legally, they had to do that. So you could argue, of course, right, the dollar was backed by gold. When exactly that, mechanism sort of broke down, from a market standpoint, is up for debate. But the actual Nixon shock happened in 71, and the U.S., you know, officially removes itself from a gold standard. And, you know, it's a very interesting time, and everyone is sort of like, okay, well, here's the end of the dollar. You know, there's going to be de-dollarization, all these things. And actually what happened was we saw military presence from the United States, you know, really significantly ramp up in the Middle East and in Saudi Arabia. And we saw an establishment with the Saudi government of this, petrodollar system in which for exchange for military defense, they would only allow the sale of petrol, of oil, to be denominated in dollars. So in effect, what that meant was the U.S. was able to offshore and shovel the, you know, should be inflationary effects of a depeg dollar into the Middle East, and said that anybody in Asia, anybody in Europe, really anywhere, anyone anywhere that needed oil, that wanted to industrialize, they needed to buy dollars first. So we created an artificial demand for dollars. I say we, like I had anything to do with it, but, you know, the U.S. created an artificial demand for dollars by establishing this petrodollar system. And, you know, for 50 years or so, they were able to, continue basically the U.S. Treasury Ponzi, if you will, but basically servicing U.S. debt by selling, government debt and dollars to anyone that wanted to industrialize, which frankly, anyone in the 70s, 80s, 90s, it was pretty much every country wanted to industrialize, and many of them were not oil independent. So, establish the system. It's not a de facto monopoly, of course. You know, there was settlement and other things, or rather, it wasn't a literal monopoly, but it was a de facto monopoly. So, you know, 95% plus of all, global petro sales were denominated in dollars. So then we fast forward to 2020. Right as the COVID, lockdowns are starting and all of the big crash happens, right, in that like second week of March in 2020. And we see something that is, totally absurd to me being, kind of a 90s kid where all I've sort of known is the U.S. increasing presence in the Middle East. We see the, oil futures go negative. So, not quite literally, obviously it's a speculative thing, but basically they're paying people to take oil, which is just so completely absurd based on everything I've ever, sort of grown up with. And then, very shortly after, the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan, right? But a very interesting thing happening at right about that same time, 2 months later, in May, is the Bitcoin halving, which for the first time brings relative issuance down below 2%, which is, the target inflation rate of the U.S. dollar. As well as gold coming out of the ground, right? Something in that 1.5%, something like that. So right before, oil goes, or right before the Bitcoin relative issuance goes below the rate of the dollar and gold, we see this really funky thing happen in the oil markets. And that's when I would say was sort of the death of the petrodollar and the creation of the Bitcoin dollar system is in that market mechanism. And so obviously Bitcoin crashed then as well, went down to like $3,300, but it basically 20x'd within the next 12 months. pretty absurd for a commodity. So there's a lot of parallels to oil and to Bitcoin, sort of this like energy commodity. Obviously, a lot of things different. It's a lot easier to move Bitcoin around than it is to move, you know, millions of barrels of oil. But it is really an energy commodity. And we've created essentially the same de facto monopoly of the ins and outs of the Bitcoin system being, you know, 95% plus denominated in dollar pairs, whether they're stable coins or just USD, but mostly stable coins. And so we've in effect created another, you know, demand for US dollars within this, you know, inflation into an energy commodity, into the pricing of a depegged energy commodity. So it used to be oil and now it's Bitcoin. And we're seeing a new demand for US treasuries in the stable coin system, which is innately linked to Bitcoin's price appreciation. So that's sort of kind of a quickie of the Bitcoin dollar system. But in effect, it's how do we create artificial demand for dollars as dollars get more and more printed and the individual purchasing power inflates away? We retain the net purchasing power, much like we did in the petrol dollar system by creating artificial demand for U.S. treasuries.
And the wild thing, I think, that might be lost on folks, they hear about all of these things and they're saying, well, who in the world would keep buying all? And they just don't have a deep appreciation for how much dollar denominated debt there is around the world.
Totally.
To the tune of trillions, and where they're going to have to go next because of impairment in fixed income markets is going to be even crazier.
Totally.
Do you buy into this idea that pretty much the only buyer kind of in the coming decade starts to become the stablecoin companies? Or who's going to buy this?
I think it is the stablecoin companies for sure. You know, I think there is sort of a movement, at least socially, of kind of this de-dollarization, you know, with BRICS currencies. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of this here and there. But we're not really seeing that in terms of actual, you know, the buyers. We're seeing huge amounts of demand for U.S. treasuries in these stablecoin providers. I think in the article we say, and again, I think it changes kind of every day because, you know, people sell, people buy. But, you know, the stablecoin issuers are like the 18th largest holder of U.S. debt in the world, which is just insane. I mean,
and
it's
growing,
you know,
at a rapid pace, just growing.
An unbelievable pace. I mean, I think $1 billion were, you know, of Tether was just minted today. Again, you know, sometimes it's redemptions. Who knows? 250 million of USDC was issued today. And what that means is there has to be some sort of underlying asset to sort of offset these liabilities, these tokenized liabilities. And so they have to buy debt to basically create more dollars. It's exactly the same mechanism done in the private sector capital creation of the banks that sort of hover around the Federal Reserve, right? I mean, the Fed doesn't print dollars. It prints treasuries with the treasury. It sets the rate of yield of these treasuries that the treasury makes. So we're seeing, you know, 180 billion-ish or so, give or take 20 billion of demand being bought by these stablecoin providers. And, you know, you look at our biggest debtors, our biggest creditors, rather, in like Japan and China, and it's just a little over a trillion, right? So already these stablecoin providers, like Tether specifically, is like a tenth of the debt held by our longest, you know, debt partners, you know, in China and in Japan. And this is so new. This is such a new currency. Or rather a new economy, and it's just going to get crazier. It's just going to build even more and more and more. And I argue, actually, that, you know, the regulatory regime of the United States, of course, is kind of, you know, they're the kingmakers. They're the ones that sort of set the policy that sort of dictates, you know, what kind of happens in the rest of the world. Obviously, it's a little Western-centric, but it's kind of true, especially for you know, the economy. I think that's kind of true. And so we're seeing right now, you know, an adoption or at least an interest in adopting, you know, new capital requirements for the United States system, like a Basel III, that would actually have a significant influence in this sort of this axiom, specifically of Bitcoin appreciating and needing dollars on the books. So if Bitcoin is determined as a liability and not really an asset in terms of balance, you know, on your balance sheet, then you need to offset Bitcoin appreciating with dollars, as this capital requirement, axiom, basically to appease, you know, hey, there's a lot of risk in having Bitcoin. So if you want to play with Bitcoin, you want to have it on your books, well, you better hold a lot of dollars too. And so it creates this artificial demand, and it creates this, you know, Bitcoin is this really special thing, right? Because it's demand inelastic. So no matter how much demand is there for Bitcoin, you know, there's a set amount of Bitcoin issued every 10 minutes. It doesn't matter how many people want it. So it's kind of the first commodity ever to really establish that. Whereas, you know, oil or gold or silver, these previous sort of energy standards, if there's a huge demand spike for gold, you know, gold 4x's in price, you can send three more people down the mine, go get a bunch more gold. There's a lot more supply that hits the market, and then demand goes down. Bitcoin doesn't care. It's completely demand agnostic. And so the supply doesn't change. So you create the system where you actually have, you know, we've created this huge debt bubble of dollars, dollar denominated debt. And now we have basically this vacuum of Bitcoin that can suck all up, you know, all of this debt, this huge bubble, and right into this demand inelastic asset. And if we create a regulatory environment that requires companies that hold in the United States, a lot of Bitcoin to hold dollars, that now we've created this mechanism for Bitcoin to appreciate, substantially, and require trillions of dollars, of dollars to be held by these institutions that hold Bitcoin. And so that's part of this Bitcoin dollar play that I think is really important with a Zappo. And that's kind of why we were looking at this piece. You know, I really wrote the Bitcoin dollar as sort of just a mechanism. Was sort of a look at, okay, well, this is kind of a complicated thing. A lot of people don't necessarily know how interest rates work or the treasury system works. And I didn't really know, you know, until I was researching the book and kind of getting into it. This knowledge is sort of obfuscated for a reason, so that we don't know
how
it
works. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Yeah, totally. And so you look at a Zappo, and they kind of built, you know, the two things that you really need to create this Bitcoin dollar system. One being obviously extreme security. You know, you want to hold these keys. You want to inflate, you know, bits and bytes to be worth trillions and trillions of dollars, which is where we think this is going as Bitcoiners. Well, you damn well better be sure that you can secure those keys really well. And Zappo really built that. They did really absurd things. As I mentioned, putting stuff in space, digging it into the ground. They even did stuff where they, you know, created these pulse, like fingerprint scanners that have a pulse reader on them, so that you can't just cut off someone's hand and put it on the thing to get someone's keys. It can tell if the hand's been cut off, right? Like all of these just super, you know, to build a system that holds trillions of dollars, you need to have this highly secure level of key management. And Zappo built that. And it wasn't really what they were trying to do. It came out of just, you know, I sold Bitcoin as this great thing to guys like Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman. And then they wanted to buy millions of dollars of it. And then it, you know, grows thousands of percent. Now it's worth billions, and it kind of came out of this just necessity of his friends saying, hey, keep these things safe for me. So you have to have that super high security. And then also you need to have, again, this regulatory environment, this capital requirement, and the Bitcoins be within the United States. That's obviously an essential part of this regulation play. And of course, Zappo sold its custody service to Coinbase in 2019, including Grayscale, including just an absurd amount of Bitcoin. I think something like 514,000 Bitcoin, I think, were transferred to the United States from Gibraltar back into the regulatory regime of the United States via the sale. Grayscale specifically did like 225,000 Bitcoin. It was like 2.7 billion at the time. It was the largest cryptocurrency transaction at the time, all bringing it back to the United States from being held out of the regulatory regime of the U.S. So Zappo really has kind of created the Bitcoin dollar system. Obviously, they don't affect regulation specifically, but then you go and you look at some of the biggest lobbyists in the country, and this is what kind of part two is going to be about. And Winsess is the head of Coin Center. He's the chair of Coin Center, which is the biggest lobby in the U.S. And, you know, Paxos, which is affiliated with them and with PayPal as well. Charles, you know, was one of the founding members of Coin Center as well. So you start to see kind of this you know, system kind of being built. Yeah, here we are with, you know, basically 1 million Bitcoin have come back to the United States just specifically via through this company, bringing, you know, selling back to Coinbase. So that's kind of where we're at. And I think
in the private markets,
the ETFs,
when you say that, you're saying yes, privately yeah. through the ETFs that are held, you know, people
exactly.
have paper receipts
yeah.
for these Bitcoin. Okay.
Right, exactly. So it's like, okay, you know, when the Bitcoin ETFs were approved in January, I think it was January 11th, there were 11 that were approved. You know, BlackRock's iBit, their iShares, you know, ETF offering, which is the fastest growing ETF, you know, in the history of ETFs. You know, I think they hold almost 400,000 Bitcoin now. They're custodying with Coinbase. Grayscale is with Coinbase. ARK21 shares is with Coinbase. Bitwise is with Coinbase. So, you know, something like 800,000 Bitcoin just with the ETFs are held by Coinbase custody, which of course is using the infrastructure set up, you know, by Zappo. So when BlackRock rang the bell for NASDAQ on the 11th, on January 11th, they invited Winsess to ring in the bell with them, which I thought was kind of interesting. You would, you know, there's really no direct affiliation between BlackRock's iBit and Zappo, except if you look at, oh, well, in 2019, actually, they sold this whole service to Coinbase. Interesting. So, yeah, that's kind of, you know, Zappo really has built the Bitcoin dollar. They were the first regulated bank to integrate USDT in 2023. They integrated USDC in 2022. And I think stablecoins being this huge demand for U.S. treasuries and this custody, you know, this just unbelievable, you know, extreme security measures, you know, being built up by Zappo. Here we are. So this Bitcoin dollar system that kind of became as sort of this idea that I had in 2021, the first time I wrote about it. Now, you know, we've seen this, you know, basically appreciate into, yeah, something that holds, you know, 5% of all liquid Bitcoin is like kind of within this Bitcoin dollar system very, very directly. So yeah, it's very interesting the way that this is developed. I think the ETFs are a huge game changer for Bitcoin. Obviously, I'm sure you know, and you've talked about it quite a bit here on the show, but this is a real game changer, and the people that built the infrastructure are, you know, right here with Zappo. Wow.
I wanted to, the Endeavor was a huge piece of the article, and you had mentioned the WEF's Young Leader, Young Global Leader Program, the YGL. For people that aren't familiar with this, like Justin Trudeau, there's a lot of other like very famous, maybe you can name more, but there's some very famous world leaders today that came out of this WEF's program. And this, you're using this almost as an example of these social groups that entrepreneurial social groups that have been stood up to reinforce and seed and kind of percolate out these bigger agendas that they're trying to
right.
do. And instead of the WEF's Young Global Leader Program, you talk about this one that's called Endeavor. So explain how this works with respect to intelligence affiliated venture capital firms kind of dominating this financial technology industry. And like how much of an impact has Endeavor really had, I guess, if you were going to, you know, put some magnitude on it, like how much has this specific organization had in your humble opinion? I know that's a very qualitative question, but
no, for sure. Well, I think the best way to answer it is kind of through, you know, the way that they explained it themselves, which it, I think is in many ways, it's kind of disturbing a little bit. Depends on how you look at free markets. But basically, you know, Bronfman in the 2009 Endeavor Gala, Bronfman came in a little bit later after the founding. I believe it was founded in 98. Bronfman came in, you know, I think about a decade later. But Bronfman came in and, you know, he does this talk at the 2009 gala, and he talks about how he was discussing with the Chilean Endeavor, entrepreneur, and was saying that the top three leading candidates in Chile at the time for the presidency all had used entrepreneurship as a pillar of their platform. All three of the basically the choices that the Chilean public had to be president were all pushing entrepreneurship. And when Endeavor was founded in 98, there was no word in the Spanish language for entrepreneur. And so he does this as, and he says very specifically, this is all thanks to Endeavor, that basically they've focused on emerging markets and specifically Latin America. And they came in and they established this private sector, you know, this blossoming of private sector activity, entrepreneurial activity, you know, in specifically, you know, I think Argentina is a huge one, Brazil. But yeah, like literally this, you know, this word didn't exist in Spanish and now everyone's pushing it. And you can see that the effect that this has on the language of the people, as well as obviously the public sector, right? I mean, these are three people running for president that are all pushing, you know, free markets and entrepreneurship. And I think a lot of people obviously will say, well, hey, isn't that good? Isn't the free market, isn't this a success over, you know, let's look at, you know, something like what's happening in Argentina now with Milei. You know, he's really pushing the free market. Isn't this great? Well, kind of. I think I am a free market capitalist. I'm not saying that we should regulate away anyone's ability to, you know, participate in the market or not be able to run for president because they made money once. Like, I'm certainly not saying that. But when you look at, you know, that these are people that are all funded by, you know, a very small group of people, that have connections, you know, significant connections, not just, you know, weak connections, but significant connections to organized crime and intelligence backed, you know, venture capital. You know, you start to see that, well, maybe this isn't really the free market. Maybe this is crony capitalism. And it's having an effect on the language of the people, right? So I think an interesting thing to looking at with Endeavor. So yeah, the YGL is basically this public sector, you know, infiltration of cabinets, and Endeavor is really going for private sector. And so I think it's important to kind of look at the history of Endeavor. So Peter Kellner and Linda Rottenberg, you know, funded and founded Endeavor, rather, having worked for this group Ashoka, which was funded by Bill Drayton. And Bill Drayton is, you know, he was a pretty big guy in the Harvard Business School. He started this thing, you know, these Ashoka roundtables where, you know, entrepreneurs and people would come together and they'd start kind of sharing ideas. And this kind of, that was sort of the first real birthplace of this sort of like multiplier effect, as Endeavor calls it. But, you know, things like the PayPal mafia, where it's like, well, how did these guys become multi-time billion-dollar, you know, founders? Like, who strikes lightning? Who strikes gold twice, right? Never mind three times, four times. And it really became, you know, it happens because, you know, they're able to use their influence to, you know, corner markets and dominate them and basically look for opportunities for monopolies and dominate them. And this is not just me speculating that. This is like, that's what Peter Thiel says. I mean, he goes up there and talks and says, go find a thing that someone is doing poorly. Don't look for competition. Competition's not good. Find a thing you can dominate and dominate.
His book Zero to One talks about like the desire to become a monopoly, like literally, right?
Totally.
In the book. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He says competition is bad for profits. I mean, that's something that it's said. And this guy is this, you know, considered this libertarian champion of the free market. And he's literally saying competition is bad for profits. So I think that's an important, you know, framework for this a little bit. Right. And again, I just want to be very clear, just so I don't lose my libertarian credibility here. I'm not saying the answer is regulation. I'm saying the answer is let's call these people out and let's call a spade, right? So yeah. Bill Drayton, this guy who funded Ashoka, he was the guy that, you know, he invented the term social entrepreneur in like the 70s in 1972. So right about the time the petrodollar is being established and we the Nixon shock happens. So he's coming out of Harvard and is bringing up this whole new idea of like the citizen sector. So you have the private sector, the public sector, and then you have this middle ground, this nonprofit sector. And there wasn't really a thing going on there in the early 70s. It wasn't really a big thing. So he comes out of Harvard and establishes this group, Ashoka, And probably the most important thing that came out of this group was this idea of like microfinance and microloans, which is obviously sort of kind of the predominant way that people think about financially affecting emerging markets nowadays is through like microloans.
Yeah, on the face of it, it sounds like, oh, that sounds like a great idea.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But then you actually look at, well, hey, what are these guys really trying to build? They understand that, hey, in the world of free money, you know, freely printed money, fiat money, it's not really necessarily about the profits anymore. Maybe there's these other, you know, things that are kind of worth more than revenue coming in than kind of these proto information brokers. You're looking at microfinance as a way to sort of grab a whole bunch of information about individuals, right? Because it's instead of, you know, these kind of, you know, neighborhood banks, you know, getting funding and being able to distribute it out, it's like you're going directly to the individual. So you're getting a lot of information about them. Plus also their higher yield. And they give these banks, you know, a lot of opportunity to, you know, make money off of the fees that happen from these micro loans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at a lot of these, you know, these sort of philanthropic ventures or, you know, even like something like, you know, like COVID response, you know, Bank of America made billions of dollars off of giving out money from the government just in processing fees. Maybe not the best example for microfinance, but it kind of is because, you know, those were fees made directly, you know, depositing money. I get money from the government. I deposit directly into your account, which is very similar to what these microloans are doing. And then I take 5% each time. You know, these it kind of centralizes power in a very specific way and gives a lot of information to these like information brokers that are kind of playing as the banks or the fintech people in this case. So now we're seeing, you know, basically this new kind of concept of philanthropy, being this microfinance and this microloan space. And Drayden actually has a quote where he says, within 5 years of being an Ashoka fellow, 50% of them change national policy in their respective countries. So even though it's, again, it's looking at the third sector, the citizen sector, this, you know, nonprofit sector, they're saying that, you know, within 5 years, half of the people are changing policy in their country. So you're seeing that directly come out of a Harvard, this, you know, really important kind of, you know, American institution is coming out here, starting this thing totally guised under philanthropic, you know, means and intents. And within 5 years, 50% of them are changing the country. You look at Endeavor. You know, they're creating new words in languages and changing policy and changing, you know, focus of what the public sector looks at, even though they're not focusing on the public sector, you know, publicly. So the Endeavor really came out of this Ashoka model, this microfinance model and this citizen sector model, and is totally having huge effects on the public sector and the people of emerging markets. And again, specifically Latin America. So, you know, Endeavor is a very fascinating kind of case study. And you start to look at, you know, well, who are sort of the Endeavor success stories? Obviously, Wences Casares is a huge one. He started Patagon. He started the first ISP in Argentina, which obviously has, you know, huge, you know, that's exceptionally important in emerging markets is who runs the internet service providers, especially as all these fintech things pop off. And then, you know, the first success story, the first Endeavor Group, you know, company to go public was Mercado Libre, which is sort of considered like the Amazon eBay of Latin America, run by this guy, Marcos Galperin, who's the richest man in Argentina. And you're starting to see, especially when you pair that with Wences Casares' Zappo, which is, you know, heavily has huge PayPal ties, former PayPal member, board member. And you start to see basically a reestablishing of, you know, what made PayPal PayPal. It was that they had a market with it, when it first, you know, really took off, which was eBay, and eBay eventually mm-hmm. bought PayPal. Mm-hmm. But PayPal never would have worked without eBay. There would have been no need to have settlement via email, basically. Settlement that also has fraud protection. That was really the big state change. It was instant settlement and fraud protection,
which led into Peter's Palantir spinoff after dealing with all of the security side of of PayPal, if I remember right.
Totally. I mean, Palantir, I mean, yeah, basically building the private sector security state.
Yeah.
And actually, very interestingly, Palantir technically started at PayPal.
Yeah.
And spun off, which is, you know, kind of disturbing, frankly. You know, basically this idea again that free markets are so great and everything's so great. Well, I don't know. I'm not necessarily cheering on Palantir being, you know, it's a government contractor. They're getting all these huge government contracts. They live off government contracts, but they actually retain more, you know, because they're private sector, they can kind of do more things that a public sector company wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah.
And this plays really importantly, again, like, not to just jump
massively,
all over here, but
massive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Totally. A public sector, a government sector company, you know, has a lot of things that they can't do because, you know, they're government sponsored or they're literally reformed in the government. So there's a lot of customer right restrictions and a lot of things that, you know, they sort of have to give everybody access to. You know, maybe there were some things about if you're a felon or whatnot or whatever, but for the most part, if you're government, you know, you're a public sector company, you have to be extremely inclusive, and your ability to just sort of restrict speech or restrict access at a whim, or even sell data at a whim, it's much harder to do. So these companies, you know, they live off of government contracts, but they're private sector. And that's exactly what Palantir is. It's essentially a privatized CIA that is a huge data broker. Yeah.
Just to give people a little bit of background on like Palantir, like we're saying these things, but we're not giving you any examples of like what they do. So like police cars, like a police mm-hmm. force could hire Palantir. They put these video cameras on the back of all their cop cars. The cops then drive around. All of that information, video content, depending on what sensors they're even using on it, I'm just assuming it's video, but there might be other things like LIDAR or whatever. They're collecting all of that data, all of that information, and then they're running basically pattern analysis. So let's say they drove past the bar and the video collected a license plate XYZ that was at the bar. It is pinning that, geolocating that license plate. And let's say that license plate's there every day at 3 o'clock when that cop car drives past the bar. They now know that so-and-so who's tied to that license plate drinks, and then they run AI and all this other stuff on all this information and data, and they have a whole construct of like what's happening in that town. And I think that people, your comment that this is in the private sector, some people might look at that and say, well, that's better than the government having it. But I think what's lost on people is the government can just then ping Palantir and say, hey, can you tell us this? And they're like, yeah, sure. We're a private company. We can tell you whatever you want, right? Like it's the
absolutely.
Privacy.
In fact, that's
totally
what they do.
Yes.
That's exactly what they do. It is exactly. I mean, like you could look at Peter Thiel as the guy who has established the company that sells your data to the government.
Yeah.
You know, you could really look at that. And I think that, you know, the contracts sort of speak for themselves that yes, this is, you know, InQtel, right? Which we haven't even talked about yet. InQtel was essentially, it was the CIA basically saying, hey, the dot-com boom is happening. You know, the 90s are happening. And we need to compete with Silicon Valley. And the way that we compete with it is by becoming it, mm-hmm. right? And the way that we do that is by VC firms. And you know, a lot of them are shadow VC firms, but InQtel is actually directly, the CIA affiliated venture capital firm, and InQtel specifically helped create Palantir. And Palantir's, you know, first contract was the CIA, and they fed off the CIA for an extremely long time. But so yes, they are quite literally, it's hard to say if it's, you know, if it started in the public sector and moved into the private sector, or, you know, or it was a private sector from the beginning, but funded by public. It's all kind of wishy-washy and nebulous by design. Again, I would say by design. And I think this mechanism of private and public is very interesting when you understand that, okay, the CIA has created a venture capital firm. It's investing in companies like Palantir, like Chain Analysis. And then also as we're coming to the digitalization of money. So there's a lot of talk about how bad CBDCs are, which of course they are. They're not great. We don't want the government to have all this information. We don't want the government to be able to blacklist or you know, do a lot of these things with you know, users' money. It's a very obvious, easy thing to see as being like an overreach of power. But people don't apply that same skepticism to private bank digital currency, which is what a lot of these, you know, sort of stablecoin issuers are. You know, you look at a Tether, and again, I understand a lot of people have a lot of sympathy for stablecoins in the emerging markets. You know, hey, it's better than inflating peso. But, you know, you look at, you know, they've integrated the FBI, the Secret Service. They've integrated InQtel funded chain analysis into their platform. They're buying up U.S. debt, you know, as much as anybody. And because they're private sector, they actually, again, retain a lot of this, this blacklisting ability, this restriction, you know, this ability to seize funds, to restrict your spending, a lot of things that maybe a government issued currency couldn't do. They wouldn't maybe be able to restrict customer access, right?
My issue with bashing the stablecoin issuers and all of it is just when I look at where we're at with the legacy system and and transmuting all of that over to this Bitcoin system, which actually has a peg and all the things we talk about every show, you know, and that we talk about at Bitcoin Magazine. I just don't know how you port that legacy system from where it was to where we need to go without there being some type of private. I would much rather have some type of private CBDCs in the form of 100 of them or 10 of them or whatever than one U.S. government entity that's then managing a CBDC. And Mark, I don't think we can get from there to where we're going without this happening or this being here. So then the question becomes, so like, what's a better solution than this? I don't know. I can't answer.
Yeah, it's very, it is interesting. And again, I do have a lot of sympathy for it. And again, anyone that says they know what the answer is a liar, because no one knows. You know, this, we're learning this in real time. Markets are 24/7. You know, we're all learning here. But I would push back a little bit on this idea that, you know, I think there's innately a king making element to the treasury market. Right. I mean, the U.S. government is essentially saying, yes, we approve Tether because we're selling it boatloads of U.S. treasuries and not seizing the treasuries and saying, OK, well, we'll sell you another $50 billion of treasuries if you integrate chain analysis, you integrate the Secret Service, you integrate the FBI, you know, and so there is sort of this kind of, you know, there again, it's sort of a pun, but, you know, there is a tether to the U.S. government and the U.S. Ponzi by creating, you know, a mechanism where they sort of have to play ball with what the U.S. government wants, or what the public sector wants. And I would again say that, yes, this idea that there should be a lot of them is better than the idea that there should be one, which I definitely agree with. But how do you, you know, how can we create dollar instruments and kind of do have this transitional period into a Bitcoin system? Is there a way to do it that doesn't perpetuate the U.S. Treasury market? And I think that there are. I think there are ways to build what is in effect a dollar instrument that doesn't perpetuate government debt and doesn't allow
DLCs and Lightning. Is that where you're going with it?
Sure, or eCash or whatever it is. I think there are really clever mechanisms that we can build. And so I think it's important to clarify, and this is why I appreciate the pushback, and it's a great question, is like, well, I'm not like, I don't think the dollar as a mechanism or as an idea is a bad thing. I think it's a role in the way that the treasury market perpetuates the military industrial complex, the way that the U.S. government has used the U.S. dollar system via the treasury market, via the debt market, to basically enact financial terrorism on, you know, the global south through like debt weaponization.
Yes.
You know, let's defang that. You know, we have Bitcoin. Bitcoin maybe can't necessarily work as a currency for 8 billion people, for every single purchase that they need to make in a day. You know, there are some limitations to how many transactions you can fit into a block, even with covenants, even with layer two solutions. You know, there are some limitations. I'm not like naive to that. I think we can do a lot better. I think we can onboard billions of people to Bitcoin. I definitely don't. I'm not. You know, I haven't given up on that idea. But how do we create Bitcoin to be basically a reserve asset? That's really what it is. I mean, I think it works really well as a reserve asset. It maybe can't compete with the dollar, but it certainly can compete with treasuries as the settlement network that other currencies are built on top of. So why can't we have US dollar instruments that are backed by Bitcoin and be successful that doesn't perpetuate the treasury market? So a lot of the things that people say about, you know, about Tether and about this and that USDC and that, you know, there's such this huge dollar demand and, you know, we can't go overnight. Sure. But that doesn't mean we need to perpetuate the treasury market. So I'm very sympathetic to this idea that people need dollars or want dollars and that Bitcoin is not ready to monetize as a currency yet. I'm totally sympathetic to that. But let's build the system that, you know, doesn't, you know, kick the can down the road for the U.S. government one more time. Let's not recreate the petrodollar system. You know, let's be clever. Let's write code. Let's be cypherpunks. Let's do some clever things here to basically use Bitcoin as a reserve asset for a dollar-esque instrument that doesn't touch treasury. So, and I think that's totally possible, whether you use, DLCs, as you said. There's some really interesting things going on with like stable channels, basically using like a lightning channel where one side is long the dollar, one side is short the dollar, you know, things like that, eCash, that you know, create basically this idea of the dollar without perpetuating the debt Ponzi. So let's do that. Let's be clever. Unfortunately, and I'll give you a little alpha here, this is something that working on, you know, for the next piece here is, you know, obviously the biggest example of the algorithmic stablecoin is Terra Luna, of course.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get too much into it, but the main reason you could argue that the Terra Luna protocol imploded was, you know, these super high unsustainable yields that were being perpetuated by the system. And the main, you know, the highest yield in the system were over 72% of all of Terra's you know, wealth was stuck in at the time of popping, was in this thing called the Anchor Protocol. And the Anchor Protocol was designed by this guy, I believe his name is Ryan Park, out of Korea. And he was given a Thiel Fellowship to build Anchor, and basically create, you know, this,
know that.
This, no one knows it. It's not really a well-known thing. And so you look at, well, okay, how come every single regulation, every single stablecoin bill, like the Gillibrand Lummis bill, you know, you're looking at this, how come they always talk about, you know, how algorithmic stablecoins are bad? You know, why is that? Why did we manufacture this consent to basically say that, you know, no, Bitcoin can't be used to create dollar instruments. You know, we can't do that. You could very much so make that claim that this was manufactured consent for treasury-backed stable coins lieu of algorithmic stable coins.
No doubt.
And now we're seeing PayPal is, you know, partnered with Paxos and is doing PYUSD. And I actually talked with Walter Hessert, who's the head of strategy at Paxos, and he said PayPal is incredibly well positioned to capitalize on the incoming boom of trillions of dollars of highly regulated stable coins in an environment where USDC and USDT probably won't survive. Now, again, he's pushing his bags, right? You know, I mean, he's obviously very connected with Paxos. Who's to say what crystal ball he has for where regulation is going? But he's basically coming out and saying, you know, a couple important things. And the main one being trillions of dollars of highly regulated stablecoins means what? Well, it means trillions of dollars of treasuries that are being bought by stablecoin providers.
We're talking money printing by a winner that's already been pre-selected. Yeah. Well, when
exactly.
I look at Tether, like so much of it's euro dollars that they're basically, you know, sucking
right
out of the market. I want to explain to the listener real fast. And if I get any of this wrong, please correct me, Mark. But when you say a lightning channel dollar stable coin, imagine.
Sure.
Mark and I basically opening a channel together. Let's say that we open a, you know, 10,000 sat channel with each other. And we also construct a discrete log contract, basically a smart contract that follows the price of the dollar And every 10 minutes or every hour or whatever we define inside of that discrete log contract, it updates with the amount of sats that then need to flow to Mark or back to me based on who's taking the long dollar side and who's taking the long Bitcoin side. And if you get enough people to open these channels with each other, your risk is very, very different than Terra Luna, as far as a synthetic stablecoin, which was almost like a consolidated debt obligation, like the 2008, like where you're chunking all this stuff in there and you got yield and everything. There's no yield associated with this. This is just a constant. Now you need a good reference spot price for it to, because this is effectively a derivative in this channel, a derivative of the dollar. And if you do this at scale, these micro channel dollar stable coins, you get in a weird world where it's all Bitcoin, but it's moving and representing dollars without having to buy treasuries or any of that stuff. And this is, in my humble opinion, really fascinating stuff. And I think that in the coming 5 to 10 years, especially when you get into developing nation states that probably aren't using or don't need really large channel capacity, but need some type of hedge in dollar terms for whatever debts they've got, I think this one gets really fascinating really fast. I'm curious if you have any other comments on that, Mark.
Yeah, 100%. I had a really interesting conversation at Bitcoin Azores last year with this gentleman, Tony, who developed this idea of stable channels. And he actually came up to me and he was like, "Hey, I read your book." And I've actually done a lot of work not to dox or anything, but in kind of tokenized treasury systems and kind of worked with some of these banks. And he was like, "I don't want to perpetuate this stuff. I don't like this stuff. You know, I don't want to be the guy, you know, building these things for these banks. So I'm going to go work on a Lightning based system that, you know, yeah, as exactly as you said, it's all Bitcoin. It's very, very cool. It doesn't touch dollars at all, but it gives, you know, what is essentially like the idea of a dollar, mechanism to one side of the, to whoever's long, you know, the dollar, on their side of the channel. And yeah, as you said, you know, Lightning, you can pass back and forth, you know, you can update it as much as you want. You could update it every 30 seconds. You could update, you know, using your Oracle, basically update it every 10 minutes, whatever you want. Obviously, there is some trust involved, as always there is in some HTLCs in Lightning, but you can always leave. You can always close the channel. You can always take your money whenever you want. You can't get rugged. You can't give the money to the other player unless, you know, it's not, in any way that isn't an agreed upon at the time of the writing of the contract. Someone can't just run away with your money, which is not true of something like a Terra Luna, obviously. So yeah, I think it's very, very fascinating. I think Lightning is going to be a really interesting, settlement layer for a lot of these things. And I've written about this in regards to eCash, which is, you know, a custodial mint that gives you, you know, pretty good privacy within the mint. And you can kind of create, you know, things that, you know, decently private payments that then you can settle out with Lightning. And there's some trust involved, but it's pretty good depending on, you know, this idea that everything is going to be built without trust, I think, is a little bit nutty. Obviously, we want to minimize.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you want to send a Bitcoin transaction and you don't want to have any trust at all, you don't need to. Just settle something on the Bitcoin layer. Totally fine.
Amen.
Use Lightning and do it that you're entering an agreement with someone else to have a shared channel. Obviously, there's limitations of what they can take from you, but you know, it's as long as you can settle and close the channel, it's pretty trustless, right? eCash, not quite so. The mint has, the ability to rug you or debase you, depending on how long you have exposure to the mint. But if you have very minimal exposure to the mint, you can do some pretty interesting things. So I think we're going to see Lightning, evolve and be really interesting and connect a lot of these systems. But yeah, if you want to trust the system, that's what Bitcoin's for. I mean, that's why it's a state change. It's this unbelievable, this tool, that really empowers people to have, trustless settlement without a trusted third party. I think the thing that people miss about this, though, of course, is that this also empowers the baddies or the U.S. government or the private sector ghouls that have, you know, run crony capitalism, you know, for the last 50 years plus or whatever. Right. So I think that this idea that Bitcoin just eliminates corruption is just ridiculous. Of course not. There can be corruption in a Bitcoin system. What there can't be is monetary debasement. You know, they can't just, you know, continually debase our funds now that we have a place that we can hold our money in that, you know, can't be inflated away. Bitcoin is a disinflationary system. Eventually it will be deflationary. And that's a state change of money. And so that's phenomenal. So it goes both ways, right? It's like I'm in this funny place right now with Bitcoin where it is everything I always thought it could be, which is fascinating seeing this play out. Now, you know, it's the biggest talk of the election cycle. You know, you're seeing this thing that was a twinkle of an idea in 2021 is now, you know, the Bitcoin dollar system is really here. It's the presidents are talking about it. You know, we're fully in. You know, we're not turning back. But it empowers the ghouls of the financial system as much as it empowers, you know, the unbanked and the global south. So I think we just need to be wary of that and aware of it, really more so than wary of it. And so the systems that we build, are we really building sustainable systems that empower people, or are we building systems that perpetuate the U.S. Treasury system? And Bitcoin can, you know, really it can defang the Treasury system. So let's let it do that. Yeah. And let's learn and see what mechanisms are being built and who's really the money behind these mechanisms. And that's really the purpose of this piece, I guess, if we could kind of sum it up, is that, you know, wow, there's InQtel money. There is CIA directors, you know, on the board of Greylock Partners who are, you know, seed funders of, you know, a lot of these companies. They're connected, highly connected with Endeavor Catalyst, which is the venture firm of Endeavor, that's heavily connected with the Zappo. And, you know, you're beginning to see sort of intelligence, crony capital linked players building the Bitcoin dollar system. And so how do we not support these groups and, you know, again, build right code and educate people that, you know, we really have an opportunity here to make a difference as we, you know, move into the Bitcoin era, because I think it's undoubtedly we are in a new financial system for sure. You know, I mean, Larry Fink is out there shilling our bags, right? Yeah, I mean, we got the biggest money manager in the world shilling our bags. Why and how can we you know, not just get rich and you know, forget about the ethos of why we're here, which is, you know, I'm not here to get rich. It's a cool side effect, but I'm here to be free. You know, I'm here to, I saw what happened. I was, you know, 18 when 2008 happened. I was a little too young to really participate in it, but like I remember Occupy and walking the streets of Occupy, and then it got very co-opted and kind of this ethical movement sort of deteriorated. And, you know, now we're kind of back doing this again, and the crony capitalists are sort of running amok doing their thing again. And I would really like, you know, I don't trust a lot of these players. I don't trust a Larry Fink. I've seen what he's done, you know, buying up a lot of these places and buying up infrastructure and commodities, you know, across the global South. And I just have a lot of trust issues, rightfully so, I would say. So I hope Bitcoiners don't lose that. It's not to say we can't celebrate. Hey, okay, let's have a little cheers. It's the presidents are talking about our bags. That's fun. But let's remember why we're here, and how we can build systems that actually truly give us an alternative. You know, that's what I'm here for.
Well, I love it. And I think at the end of the day, the proof of work of what you're saying and preaching right there is in the articles and the thought pieces that you are clearly working very hard to produce and putting out there. And at the end of the day, it's all about education. It's all about shining a flashlight in all these dark corners to help people decide for themselves whether they agree with your article or not agree with your article. All the information is there. All the resources are there for them to spot check and go find out whether they believe it or they think it's spun a certain way or whatever.
Totally.
And that's what I love about your work and Whitney's work. And I can't thank you enough, Mark, for coming on. The name of this article for people, The Chain of Custody, The Mafia Holding the Elite's Bitcoin, We'll have a link to this in the show notes. We'll have a link to Mark and Whitney's Twitter. Anything else that you want to highlight or point the listener to, Mark?
I mean, I think you really just nailed it right there at the end is, you know, don't trust me. And not that I don't try so hard to be a trusted voice, but it's not like I don't want you to just offshore your trust to me. You know, I'm just a guy with an internet access, you know, like same with Whitney, you know, same with yourself. You know, we're just desperately looking for, you know, for meaning, for truth, for whatever. And don't trust my spin. Don't trust my, you know, thesis or my idea. Like, look at the links, look at the source material. You know, there's obviously been a lot of trust lost in media, which I think is rightfully so. But let's not just then, you know, just place that in new voices and new talking heads, because I think that that is a huge part of sort of where we're going next is, OK, well, mainstream media is dead. Alternative media is here. But a lot of these alternative media guys and gals aren't necessarily to be trusted either. And, you know, I think develop trust with people that you care about, that you like, you know, you watch, you know, this show, you watch shows that I'm on or Whitney or read our stuff, and you develop relationships with pundits. But really make sure you're trusting the source material. There's a reason why basically every sentence in this thing has a link, you know, because, you know, there's so much, you know, like source material that needs to be poured over. And there's a lot of stuff that I miss, too. And there's a lot of stuff I'm going to continue to miss. There's also a lot of stuff I purposely don't put in, not because I'm trying to avoid conflict against my thesis, but stuff that is just, you know, maybe not super, super relevant. You know, there's a couple things in here that, you know, just aren't necessarily that relevant, but are interesting. Go jump off this work, go find other things in here, find your own research veins, you know, find cool things, share them, because I think we really have to kind of decentralize, you know, truth finding, and we shouldn't just re-onshore it to, you know, trusted figures that then can be manipulated or incentivized, you know, to work against us. So, yeah, trust me as far as you can throw me, which probably isn't super far. Look into the work itself. I love the writing. That's what I'm here for. I love the interviews too. Love catching up with friends. It's great. But, you know, really take a look at the work, take a look at the links and make your own conclusions and find your own research veins and then share them back with me. So, but yeah, Preston, man, absolute pleasure. Really appreciate it. As I was saying, when we talked kind of coordinating this, you know, I think you were, you know, one of the few people that really at the beginning were, you know, I think being very intellectually honest about stable coins and treasury demand. And you were very early on to this. So, you know, I was excited to come on and talk and yeah, appreciate the love, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Mark. Such a pleasure having you.
They want people to vote for them. Then we tell them that Bitcoin's good for them. Bitcoin's good for their people. Bitcoin's good for society. Bitcoin fixes a lot of issues. It doesn't just fix money, but it fixes energy. It fixes politics. It fixes so many parts of our lives. We need to sell this to them.